Doué?
Yep.
Single shot, 21, soft sticks.
When I was growing up in the 1950s in Kenya, I just had this sort of slightly true blue, you know, effect that, you know, basically the Brits did things the right way. We thought the sort of British Empire, all those red countries on the map, you know, looked great, you know, and I presumed that we British, we were the good guys and we were trying to beat the bad guys. But then later I discovered that when we came to our own struggle here, that wasn't quite true.
The Mau Mau Uprising is an armed freedom movement that takes place in Kenya in the 1950s. It is one of the most violent armed struggles in the British Empire.
The battle cry was land and freedom.
Mau Mau kuvaga kwaori, mabagite bururi-ini witu.
Both sides commit violent atrocities, but it's the colonial side that has often been ignored by historians.
The British might say they don't do torture, but we, the Mau Mau people, have gone through their torture.
For the first time, the release of new documents has given us a very much fuller account as to what had been done and why, and how the British had tried to justify it.
And now, because of the new documentation, historians in Britain and in Kenya, they're investigating how the British atrocities were institutionalized and they were known from the top in London all the way down into Kenya.
It really flips the script as to who is uncivilized.
When the British decided to leave Kenya in 63, they took with them more than 1,500 government files, all marked top secret. Over the next 40, 50 years, these documents were spirited away and hidden in a facility known as Hanslope Park, linked to GCHQ, which is used by MI5, MI6, hidden in plain sight. And when you tried to request these documents, you were told that they didn't exist.
They are in their 70s and 80s now, but they travelled thousands of miles from their homes in rural Kenya, seeking justice they say is more than half a century overdue.
I was involved in the Mau Mau legal case in 2011-2012 as an expert witness, and a request by the court in the Mau Mau case brought the Hanslope disclosure to light. However, the British government deliberately settled the case out of court in order to avoid a full hearing where the details of what had happened would be rehearsed.
They knew it. They wanted only to deny.
And therefore, only a very small fraction of the documents were actually used. And it's only now, several years on, we've had time to look at these documents more closely, that we can really begin to tell you what those documents revealed.
In 1952, Kenya was a colony of the British. It had been a colony since 1920 officially, sort of overseen by the Colonial Office in the UK. So the reality is the British came here to take stuff, not to help us out.
We have a group of white settlers with hundreds, some even thousands of acres of land, living very lavish, hedonistic lives at the cost of the people who work for them.
The British got a little bit greedy and we wanted more land.
If you did not call a settler Bwana, you have committed a crime and you are allowed to be put in prison for that reason. And therefore I said no. This is not to continue. I must join those people who are fighting for liberation of our country. What you can not do peacefully, you can achieve through war.
In Nairobi, capital of Kenya, Europeans and Africans walk the streets in fear of the dreaded Mau Mau. For it is that band of fanatics whose bloody deeds have cast a dark shadow across the face of Kenya.
The Mau Mau uprising was a peasant uprising. They were standing up against the British, demanding return of their lands, and actually demanding for independence.
There were something like 25,000 fighters. They were mostly individuals who had been in some way disinherited or had their land dispossessed. They were the have-nots, if you will, of African society.
The Mau Mau begin targeting a small number of white settler families.
You had really gruesome cases of children being killed in their beds, women being raped and being murdered.
But in the whole of that violence, only 32 white civilians were killed. But thousands of black Kenyans were killed by the Mau Mau.
Among Africans, there are many who really are opposed to Mau Mau. They don't like its violence. They think the violence is unnecessary. Now, that doesn't mean that those Africans like colonialism. And the British called them loyalists. And that makes it seem that they were pro-British. But that's far from the truth.
To deal with the Mau Mau, the British employed home guards, loyalists. They bribed them to carry out their job of beating the freedom fighters.
So the Mau Mau, they begin assassinating these colonial collaborators, chiefs and headmen.
Atrocities that were committed by the Mau Mau against fellow civilians were immense.
War is war. If any home guard had a rifle, a pistol, to shoot a Mau Mau person, would he be spared? No, because that is war.
British realize that the only way they can stop this, the only way they can preserve their rule in Kenya is by declaring this formal state of emergency in October 1952. They resolved that they're simply, by executive order, going to put people in detention camps. In these camps, there's a mix of actual Mau Mau fighters with innocent people that have been picked up.
British government like to see it as a conflict between good and evil.
But what recent revelations have shown us, together with the work that historians have done, have much of the British counterinsurgency effort was equally brutal, equally violent, and that they then tried to hide evidence of what happened there.
Hour after hour, trucks and armored cars roll out with heavily armed troops. Every province is visited in an effort to stamp out the Mau Mau menace and restore peace to troubled Kenya colony.
Propaganda was a very important tool within the Mau Mau struggle. And so the words that we see being used to describe the Mau Mau are terrorists, savage, maniacs, devils.
The dehumanization of the enemy reaches the point that excessive violence becomes sort of tolerated.
You're seeing members of regiments made up of Kenya settlers taking summary justice, executing prisoners.
There were bounties for individual British soldiers for how many sort of Mau Mau guerrillas they could kill.
But the early excessive behaviour by settlers and by the British Army gradually gives way to a more sinister and more worrying set of stories about wholesale torture going on in the context of what are known as Home Guard posts. And those armed African loyalists are staffed and led by European officers. At this time, the Prime Minister in the UK is Winston Churchill. And Churchill takes quite a lively interest in what's gone in Kenya. He's very much concerned about what's happening. And he wants it tidied up.
Well, Colonel Young's plane is waiting on the apron outside, and in a few moments' time, he'll be taking off for Kenya. It's not so very long, is it, since you came back from Malaya, Colonel?
No, I came back on the 1st of May last.
Arthur Young's dad was a builder, so he's coming from very humble origins compared to most of the colonial officials.
He's viewed as someone who has a strong sense of what is proper and what is just, and that he can reorganise the force and to get them back within the rule of law.
Well, how do you feel about going to Kenya?
Well, I feel very enthusiastic now I know I have to go.
When Young is appointed, I think he's very optimistic. He thinks he'll manage this. This is an interesting challenge. He's looking forward to it. But within 2 weeks of getting to Nairobi, he'll change his mind.
Young starts to investigate crimes carried out by the authorities, as does his assistant, who is head of the CID in Kenya, Duncan McPherson.
He goes after individual cases that have been reported and knocks on doors, talks to people.
And between them, Young and McPherson start to uncover instances of major human rights abuses.
no kamatimu mari oro rugongeini ru rwa thungu ngikomana nie ona nginyagia ciana ciakwa agikomana ki iria ndari nacio.
The cases that McPherson and Young investigate all involve European officers either directly carrying out the alleged acts or subsequently helping to cover up and conceal them by acts of deliberate deception.
These cases are presented to the Ministry of Legal Affairs in Kenya, the Attorney General, but they then go into a preliminary investigation. So it's out of the hands of Young and McPherson. That's when suddenly they disappear. Suddenly there's not enough evidence. Suddenly the investigations don't proceed.
Young begins to understand that this resistance is going on at the highest possible level. How was this happening?
The British government recognizes that Kenyans were subject to torture and other forms of ill treatment at the hands of the colonial administration.
The case that was won out of court in 2013 was really something of a Pyrrhic victory. Having decided to make the out-of-court settlement, William Hague, then Foreign Secretary, made a statement before Parliament in which he essentially apologised to the Kenyan people. But like all such statements, the apology was quite diplomatic. And Hague chose his words with great care.
We continue to deny liability on behalf of the government and British taxpayers today for the actions of the colonial administration in respect of the claims.
He made it very clear that the blame for this did not lie with the British government, but it lay with the colonial government in Kenya. So he made a distinction between the two, between London and Nairobi. But we now know that for the British government to say London had had no hand in what had happened, it was at the very least being economical with the truth, and some would say distorting the history. The release of new documents in the Hanslop disclosure has given us a very much fuller account of what McPherson was trying to do and how he was being obstructed. For the first time, we began to get a really clear picture of how the executive in Nairobi deliberately suppressed evidence. The key mechanism in this process was something called the Governor's Complaints Committee. It was set up towards the end of 1953 by the colonial administration in Nairobi to handle complaints against government officials.
Cases of alleged assaults, rapes, murders, particularly in and around Home Guard posts. But in fact, I would describe the Governor's Complaints Committee as a kind of kangaroo war crimes tribunal. It was three or four officials who basically decided which cases were worth investigating and which weren't. When you look at their files, you find that there are individual minutes, and in those minutes, they're dismissing cases out of hand. No case, decision not to prosecute, something along those lines. What they're doing is talking to local district commissioners, local district officers, who are the allies of the people that have committed these crimes, and blocking investigations by following the advice of the people that are committing the crimes, essentially, or are covering up the crimes. It's asking them to mark their own homework.
The Governor's Complaints Committee dealt with more than 350 cases. Of those that are investigated, less than 10% ever come to court. So at the end of the day, I think you'd come to the conclusion that the Governor's Complaints Committee successfully suppressed nearly 300 cases, if not more.
What's particularly shocking about the Complaints Committee is that their minutes, the direct evidence that cases were being suppressed, were being sent all the way up the chain to the governor, to the colonial secretary in London.
The colonial secretary, Alan Lennox Boyd, he's fully informed. And for the first time, we can show that from the documents we know were passing across his desk. And the colonial secretary reports to cabinet So we have to assume the cabinet must know something. They can't know nothing.
The colonial secretary, he was a representative of Her Majesty's government. So I don't know how you separate British government from Kenya colonial government. They were one and the same.
Therefore, denying that the British government is not responsible is hypocrisy.
But that's not how Lennox Boyd sees it. If your forces, if your troops are accused of human rights abuses, that is, in a sense, something that is going to be weaponized by your enemies. It's going to get in the way of ultimate victory. And what matters is to win the war against Mau Mau.
He doesn't see Kenyans as people who have rights that deserve to be protected, as people whose dignity needs to be reaffirmed.
Young is frustrated that so many cases he's uncovered of major abuses of human rights have not been prosecuted.
Young feels it's a complete smack in the face against the rule of law, and he submits his resignation.
Arthur Young goes back to the UK, where with the colonial secretary, they craft a much more toned-down press release. But it really glosses over the sorts of things that he had uncovered and the complicity of the colonial regime in the atrocities that were being committed.
The release of new documents and Haslop disclosure was transformative, and it gave us really fresh insights on what had actually happened in Kenya. The resignation letter is extraordinarily powerful in that Young makes no bones at all about his concerns about the lack of the rule of law and interference by the executive in Nairobi.
The reason he gives for resigning is that he has been entirely obstructed by the colonial government in attempting to reform the way justice is done in Kenya.
He is furious. He's understood that he is being deliberately outmaneuvered. One of the key unintended consequences of Young's resignation is that it empowered those who wished to take a firmer line against Mau Mau. Tortures would now become run by the state in institutions in a controlled and measured way. This would be far, far worse than anything that had gone on before.
By 1956, only 1,000 Mau Mau remained at large. The leaders were captured and temporary peace was restored to the African jungle.
The problem that is faced by the colonial government is they have essentially, by this point, put tens of thousands of Kenyans in detention camps that are meant to hold people who are suspected of being in the Mau Mau and who have failed to renounce their oath of allegiance to the Mau Mau.
By 1955, that's over 80,000 people that have been detained in this whole set of camps across the breadth of Kenya. But the colonial government doesn't want to let them go simply because they have to. They want to rehabilitate them. They want to stop them being Mau Mau supporters.
Mr. Breckinridge, what do you see as the main aim of your rehabilitation work? The main aim is to try and bring these rather fanatical people back to normal life, to clear the Mau Mau out of their system and bring them back to normal, decent, civilized people again.
But in the detention camps, there's a large body of irreconcilable Mau Mau supporters who are not going to confess.
They imprisoned me for 7 years. You must take an oath that you cannot surrender. Surrendering is out of question. Better die.
These camps are costing a huge amount of money, which is coming directly from the British state.
And so there's increasing pressure from London, but you need to somehow do this more quickly, get men to confess much more quickly than they had been.
And what's the fastest way to make people confess?
They come up with the idea of what becomes known as the dilution technique that was designed to separate hardcore Mau Mau into small groups, subject them to a massive degree of torture and compel them individually to confess, and then use those who'd confessed to bring around those who were resisting. And there are both Africans and Europeans involved in this torture.
They could bring pieces of broken bottle and they could use that to shave your head. And then when they finish, you have all these scars.
They would get pliers, get hold of their testes. If they refused to confess, they would in fact be castrated.
Acho mande que sore acho ne mbara mahura gandu digari ile siari ko na kendo imagi tongore tono mudungu sio tika make make ninge mudungu sio ne wetwonaga.
One of the figures that is central to the dilution technique and its execution on the ground is Terence Gavahan. He's a camp administrator, a colonial administrator, that is responsible for one of the largest camps in Moya.
I saw Terence Gavahan. He was very brutal officer.
Gavahan lingye doe onge mororogwa na reramu ando marete ra iniogwa mabange toita atano ne aboragando ne irato na komakona nambi abo ado iram monota tan indira ko irona ko kwa kwa kwane kwa ka ko kwa ne monyaka monene.
Gavahan gave several TV interviews. He was always keen to be the spokesperson for what happened with Mau Mau in Kenya.
Manipulative force, in no way punitive force. Manipulative force, you take somebody's trousers off, it takes a bit of doing. You know, it's a kind of rape. So that is done. And then if somebody howls, then it has to be maybe 10 minutes of enforcement.
And what did that require?
Well, what I've just described.
What does it mean, enforcement, though?
Well, enforcement, manhandled, so that a man who is standing up is down, that his head is on one side while he's being shaved, that his trousers are pulled off, that he's put into trousers. And so...
Were they ever knocked unconscious?
No. Never.
Do you feel any sense of guilt about those days?
None whatever.
Did anyone ever die under your regime?
No. Not one of 20,000.
Wow. He doesn't seem like he's talking about human beings. It just brings home to you just how we were seen, our pain, our suffering as inconsequential.
At the time he did that interview, I screamed, "You lying!" He knows exactly what he did. He knows exactly how he did it.
Up until now, this story has been he said, she said, in relation to Gavahan. But now, with the Hanslope disclosure, what that enables us to do is show that Gavahan was guilty of exactly the things that he's denying. The document that I think that reveals the worst atrocities that were happening in camps under Gavahan's control refer to the case of Samuel Githu.
Samuel Githu is a classic example of an African violence worker. They were the creation of the British state, often supervised by Europeans and instructed in torture. Githu eventually is accused of murdering one of the detainees who is undergoing the dilution technique. The prisoner is given a shovel and told to dig his own grave. He is then taken from the pit, very, very badly beaten.
Samuel Githu continues to kick him and thereafter forcing the detainee to carry a bucket that is filled with maybe 50 pounds of soil around the site. The detainee collapses and dies. So this is a case with which Samuel Githu is tried for.
One of the most striking things that we've revealed from the Hanslope disclosure is Githu and Gavahan were quite close friends as well as being colleagues. And Gavahan actually writes several fairly lengthy letters about the Githu case.
He says, "My own experience in the Moya camps does not seem to differ widely. At any time, I could have been in exactly the same danger of prosecution as he has been."
Gavahan is directly identifying himself with a man committing such horrific acts of torture.
He concedes that he and his colleagues are doing exactly the same thing every day that Sam Githu has been prosecuted for.
Now, what is that if not an admission of guilt?
So the new evidence in the Hanslope files unquestionably provides evidence that Gavahan admits that he was actively involved in the torturing of prisoners. We could have confronted Gavahan with this evidence, but in 2001, we didn't have it.
I think that the most shocking element of this story is that under the legal arrangements that are made during the emergency, the kind of violence that Gavahan is committing is justified, it's tolerated, it's legalized.
The British government knew you can't openly condone torture. And so there is an attempt to come up with a way to make this legal.
And so the Kenyan Attorney General creates this distinction between what he calls compelling force, which is legal in his view, and punitive force, which isn't.
But compelling force is very loosely defined.
And this is a carte blanche for the camp officers to do anything, provided that it's a means to the end of getting a confession.
These kind of false distinctions that are used to sanitize what essentially is a torture.
The governor sends this legal definition to the Secretary of State back in London, who although he's wary of it, does approve this use of force. And that becomes illegal authorization for the Kailushan method across the camps. The definition of compelling force effectively means that there is systematic torture, a reign of terror in these camps.
And the result of this is that by the middle of 1958, the remaining detention camps are an absolute powder keg.
You get riots, you get hunger strikes.
And what those in Kenya don't yet realise is that that explosion is going to affect more than Kenya. It's going to affect Britain's entire reputation as an imperial power. By 1958, the tensions between warders and the remaining detainees are acute. The lack of cooperation from the detainees has reached a peak.
The one camp where the situation escalates the most is at Hola. It is the apotheosis, the culmination of the violence that had been occurring in the camps before that.
At Hola, in early March 1959, a group of detainees from one compound, around 80 of them, they were forced out to work by being beaten until they pick up tools. And the results are catastrophic. When they're down their tools and refuse to work, a platoon of armed warders with riot shields and batons charge at the prisoners and beat them heavily. The prisoners pick up whatever they can find around to defend themselves with, boulders, stones, anything they can get. And this battle continues for the next 5 hours. By the end of this, 11 men are dead and 72 others are hospitalized.
Fafa etago migwe wadegwa aria mari kumino omwe aria moragirwo Hola masaka marega kuruta wira makihuru na njuguma ginya makiuragu nirio mathikirwo machokire magithikwo o ilimaremwe fafa witwakwa maratia twelile hingo iyo twachoka kwachoka kumenyeka thutha wona gutire undu mekire uria matiaugire kitumi kiria giatumire akue kaundu kau ni kahutetie muno.
The reaction in Parliament is really explosive.
Hola really flips the script as to who is uncivilized, you know, and who really bears the weight of the brutal torture and abuse.
Harold Macmillan is Prime Minister, and as a result of this huge parliamentary pressure on the government, they have an inquiry into what has happened.
The established narrative around Hola, quite simply, is that this was an aberration. This was an individual operation that went completely wrong.
But the new evidence does allow us to see very clearly that the British government was very, very well aware there's a danger of deaths in detention camps where dilution technique was used. But the response is simply to say, you've had your orders, get on with it.
The Hola massacre and the attendant publicity of it uncovers the abuses that were happening under the whole pipeline system. And it blows out of the water, the idea of the British having any legitimacy in holding on to Kenya.
On the surface, Nairobi is still prosperous and peaceful. But there's no doubt in anybody's mind that independence must come. The only question that remains to be resolved is when.
When would you like to see Kenya independent?
Well, I don't care any day.
Immediately.
The British government just said, let's get out of here as quick as possible. So, I mean, Hola was, what, 59? And by 63, we're already independent.
It only remains for me to present to you, Mr. Prime Minister, these constitutional instruments which established Kenya's independence.
The establishment narrative has always been that the end of empire, a consensual process. It is London sort of letting its children grow up and leave the house.
But that scenario about British benevolence, of Britain deciding that now it ought to decolonize, is not true. It was forced by circumstances.
The reality is, this is something that the British have been dragged kicking and screaming at least over 15 years into accepting. And it's that violence, it's that rupture, it's that contested nature of it that is completely elided.
What else would have been our reaction other than also taking an arms to defend ourselves?
The Mau Mau veterans, I think we owe them a lot. Without their courage, actually, in coming out and stating to the world what happened to them, we wouldn't know what we know today.
And so for me, the responsibility is to bring a sense of humanity to people who never had a say in their humanity being taken away from them.
In terms of our imperial past, there is a strong current of opinion that says these things are too long ago and that sleeping dogs should be left to lie.
For some, there is this concern that Britain's moral authority today would be weakened if Britain starts to, for example, acknowledge its own historical failings.
But talking about the atrocities that were committed in your name in the past does not injure your moral authority. In fact, it strengthens it.
I am not trashing Britain's reputation wholesale. I'm actually very patriotic, but I am very offended by the fact that people who represent my country might think it's okay to torture someone.
We need to be able to sort these things out, not to try and put it under the carpet, but to come out and confront it, learn from history.
And so, probably the way forward is for the young people in Britain to learn about what their forefathers did in other parts of the world so as not to repeat the same. And let us be good friends, full stop.